We ended last time looking at Blandon's totally unjustifiable loss of confidence in his longtime mill manager, C.K. Andrews. Even as Andrews was retiring, Blandon was blaming him for matters that were totally not his fault. In fact, there were things that Blandon himself had initiated, particularly the use of the Bulkley Dunton Company to serve as the sales representative for Blandon. But at any rate, Andrews is gone, and to replace him, his very effective management of mill affairs, Oppenheimer most earnestly recommended to Blandon that he appoint Superintendent Miles Reif, who had proven himself an able administrator, a vice president of the company, and give him overall charge of the operations of the mill. He recommended that George Gulfs oversee the engineering department and Leo Thomas supervise the accounting department. Those three men, Oppenheimer suggested, would form an operating committee to meet, discuss problems, and submit those of any major type to you for your overall approval or disapproval. Oppenheimer assured Blandon that, as long as you are here, you will be kept very much in the picture. With urgency, Oppenheimer emphasized that for the plan to succeed, it was essential that Kirk Andrews should retain a title. The lawyer further requested that Andrews be put on the payroll at somewhat reduced compensation, a recommendation that would give Andrews a stipend considerably more than just retirement pay. But knowing that Blandon was not favorably inclined towards Andrews, Oppenheimer again reiterated his arguments for retaining Andrews' services. Early in 1957, Blandon wrote Andrews to acknowledge acceptance of the recommendations made by Oppenheimer, although he added Chris Schacker, company secretary, to the operating committee. Blandon stated that he expected all decisions of the operating committee, all of them, to be submitted for his review. Andrews was given the title of advisory vice president and granted half of his previous salary. The arrangement was subject to termination on 2-week notice. Peremptorily, Blandon concluded the letter by asking that Andrews vacate his company-owned home. And that, once again, is just so unfair. The letter to Andrews was not signed, according to Schacker, because Blandon didn't feel up to it. Less than 2 months after Andrews retired, Blandon abruptly canceled the agreement, giving Andrews the required 2-week notice, after which all connections with the company would be severed. With the words, "I think we will be obliged to abandon the salary arrangement," Blandon left Andrews with nothing but retirement pay. Blandon's action shocked the other mill personnel, but he refused to change his mind, ignoring all remonstrances, even the strong and earnest entreaties of William Oppenheimer. Leaving the loyal, dedicated manager who had played so large a role in building Blandon's successful career, now with so little reward, was patently unfair. There were those who, even knowing of Blandon's illnesses, mental confusion, and lapses, could never forgive him for his action. So very, very unfortunate that one of the last major things that Blandon does is he's hanging on to control of his company is something that was so unfair as this. Well, during his last year, Blandon's health steadily regressed. Each time his physical therapist visited, she noticed further signs of deterioration. Even so, Blandon continued trying to supervise his business affairs. Chris Schacker was moved from the St. Paul office, where he'd been headquartered, to Grand Rapids, where Blandon used him as a liaison so as to keep informed of mill affairs. The arrangement was not particularly satisfactory. Blandon expected the kind of answers he had received from Andrews, hardly fair when Schacker had had little to do with day-to-day operations. And Schacker found himself in an unpleasant position. Because mill executives knew he would report back to Blandon, they hardly welcomed his visits. But Schacker performed his duties as best he could. Miles Reif found dealing with Blandon continually difficult. little could be done without his permission, and with passing months, Blandin ever more frequently either forgot he had given consent or unexpectedly reversed his own decisions. In a moment of particular frustration, Rife remarked to his wife, "There's nothing worse than a company without a future." But he devised a system of sending written memorandums to Blandin in the morning and giving him time to adjust to the contents. Then he checked with Blandin's housekeeper to determine when in the day he might be receptive to discussion. The mill managerial staff worked with and around Blandin as best they could. Let's take a look at a few memories and comments from people around Blandin at this stage of his life. A neighbor wrote, "Blandin was really serious about the appearance of the mill grounds. Every blade of grass was important. At least when he died, his maker was going to say, 'Mr. Blandin.' Even God would call him Mr. Blandin. Nobody called him anything else. 'Mr. Blandin, you have made the world a more beautiful place.'" And an employee, "I had to drive Blandin up to Little Fork one time to check on some logging operations there. When we arrived, the Finnish fellow who was running the trucks and cats came up and was introduced. He simply said, 'Well, hi, Blandin,' and shook hands. Of course, I thought the roof would fall in. You know, to everyone in Grand Rapids, he was Mr. Blandin. But Blandin really enjoyed the fellow and always asked about him after that. If you stood up to him, I think he liked you for it." And a business associate, "Mr. Blandin liked to fish, and I used to take him to Round Lake. His legs were beginning to go out about that time, and he'd stand up on the boat when we'd get a strike. Well, he wasn't the kind of man to whom you'd say, 'Sit down, Blandin,' and I'd really worry. I wasn't a good swimmer myself, and I'd think, 'How could I go back to Grand Rapids and announce, well, Mr. Blandin drowned this afternoon?' But he really enjoyed those fishing trips, and everything always did work out all right." And another neighbor, "Mr. Blandin always liked decorating, especially with lots of colored lights. In front of the villa was a long needled pine, and he wanted it decorated every Christmas. Each year it was more of a problem because it was growing, and it was a real pain in the neck for the workmen who had to do it. It was also a pain in the neck for Miles Rife, because he had to see that it was fully decorated and then lit every night. There were a lot of other trees that had to be decorated too. Mr. Blandin wanted them all with lights on. He wanted a kind of fairyland effect. Finally, as that one tree kept getting bigger, they built some kind of a frame that the workmen could use to climb up the tree, and I would assume the language was quite colorful while they were putting up the lights. Miles always kidded them a lot, and after Mr. Blandin died and the villa was demolished, the tree had to be cut down. The workmen made a picnic bench out of it and presented it to Miles so he would have lots of memories of all those years when they had to monkey around with that old Christmas tree." Obviously, we're getting very close to the end for C.K. Blandin. Next time.